Hello, everybody. I'm here today with Katie White. Katie is the executive director of Living Systems, which is a counseling non-for-profit organization in the Lower Mainland of Vancouver, right, Katie?
Yes, Vancouver, British Columbia in Canada.
Beautiful. Katie's been working with individuals, couples, children, and families for over 20 years. She received her training in university at Arizona State University. She's licensed in Arizona, and that's where she began her early work, working with families and couples and children. She later served as both a marriage and family therapist and clinical manager at nonprofit agencies, which is where a lot of us get our footing and training. And then you also lived in Sydney, Australia for a little bit.
I
And in
did.
the, what is it, the relationship counseling program over there?
Yeah, I worked as both a manager and a clinician in their relationship counseling program.
Beautiful. And now you're in Vancouver and making everybody's life better.
Well, that's a big statement.
But
Working
it's
on
great to
mine.
have you.
It's so
Me
great to be
too.
here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so Katie, just to get started, orient me in kind of how you found your way into family therapy. When we were talking a minute ago, I know you started younger than some.
Yes. So I when I actually went to university in my undergraduate and thinking I wanted to be a lawyer. I liked thinking through thought arguments, and I had a good family friend who was a lawyer, and I really appreciated him and his work. And so I thought that was the thing I wanted to do. And then I went to the University of Arizona, so the competitor for Arizona State, for any of you folks out there from Arizona. And took a political science class and said, this is not for me. This is just not what I want to be doing. I don't want to be thinking about this. And my roommate at the time was a family studies major. And so she was talking to me about the classes she was taking. And I thought, that stuff is really cool. I like that stuff. In high school, like, it's funny how you think back to these things. In high school, I was involved in like the peer counseling group, but didn't think about it as a career, just sort of thought about it as something I did there. And so I started taking some family studies classes, and then I actually was thinking I would go the social work route, but I did a social work, practicum, and I kept, working with people and then sending them off other places. And so I said, you know what? I want to be the place that they send families to. I've always been very curious about families. I told a story recently where my daughter wanted to look through these belongings of mine when I was a kid. My mom saved this box and we were visiting, and it was so hilarious to look at pages upon pages of different grade projects where I was just really interested in my family. It's just funny to go back and look at. And I don't know if I was interested or it was assigned, but these were the things that were saved. So I just, family has been in there from the beginning, Guillermo. So I then went on to get my degree in marriage and family therapy. So that's how I went up to Arizona State for my master's and got my degree in marriage and family therapy.
Yeah, just kind of drawn to the ideas of relationships and especially family, sounds like.
And I think, you know, I think I always say people often go into it because they want to help people. And I think that was a part of it for me. But I, you know, I always hope this doesn't come out wrong. But I was and continue to be just incredibly curious about people and their relationships. And, you know, I was interested from the time I was in high school. I always joke that I was good in school and then got into a little bit of trouble outside of school. And I always think about the difference between my family and how other families functioned. And I was always curious about that. And I think that's where just, I think that naturally had a lot of good classes that were presented in front of me. I just got interested in this family system stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah. What, Katie, remind me, what's your sibling position?
I am the oldest sister of sisters.
You're the oldest sister of sisters. Ella, you know, you should have been a lawyer, you know?
I could have.
You could have.
Sometimes when I'm working with a very contentious family system and I'm triangling in family lawyers, I think I could just give it all up and go do family law. I could do that. That could be another area, a second career.
No, but that's interesting that that was an initial impulse. Was part of wanting to be a lawyer, did that have anything to do with family pressure in any way, or was it just something you got in your head?
It was just something I really, really enjoyed this family friend of ours and his work and how he talked about it. And I don't even know that I would have, I mean, I think he did mostly corporate law, but just hearing about his job was really interesting to me. And I think at that time I was probably less sure of what direction. I loved school. I still to this day love school. So part of it was potentially I knew right away I was never going to stop at one degree. So that I think that was part of it. I mean, my dad was a civil engineer, and then my mom was a nurse. She did have an advanced degree. So when we were in high school, she went back and got her master's in nursing, advanced practice. So I think education was always a thing, but they didn't care what education. So it wasn't this like your, you know, those families where it's like doctor, lawyer, engineer. That was not my
It was more
yeah,
loose than that.
more loose. Education. Like there was always the expectation that we went on for advanced education, but somehow in our household we all really like learning. Like all three of my siblings and I really, really like learning. So something happened in there where they instilled that.
I've been thinking about this idea of if a certain amount of family pressure is useful, you know. But then too much pressure can be constraining, push people to rebel, conform, this type of thing. What was maybe if your experience or things you've seen with clients about this idea that kind of the useful tension versus like a less useful tension?
That's such a good question. You know, part of what I think about, I draw from Jenny Brown's thinking about the difference between when a parent moves towards a child as their project, potentially from some maybe unmet expectations that they had for themselves. I think that even if someone's not really overt about that, I think that comes through in the emotional process of, you know, they hoped this for themselves and it didn't happen, or they have this idea of where they want the family to go that they didn't take on themselves. They want the next generation to take that on. I mean, I watch that really bog down a kid. And I didn't feel that pressure of I had to get out there and do something for the family system. So I think that's the difference I watch in my own family system and with parents who can just have some looseness about, you know, like you said, we have some standards, but I'm interested in what you want to do. I'm curious about what pathway you want to take.
It's kind of like the difference between, on one hand, maybe the pressurized version would be get out there and do this specific thing versus just get out there and do something, you
Yeah,
know.
yeah, yeah. And how do you make it your own, Guillermo? And I think, you know, what would you think about that? The difference you see in your practice of.
Of somebody kind of taking up their own journey.
Yeah, versus the alternative.
Yeah, I think depending on the way people experience their family and or those early relationships and the expectations we take on, you know, people can get oriented around, I have to be this or it should look like this. And usually, hopefully earlier rather than later, people come up against the fact that that's not what they want for their own life. And then there's like a renegotiation of that. How am I using my energy? What do I actually want to do? What's fulfilling for me? What's meaningful? What gives me purpose?
I have my sister has a good friend who's pretty, I thought went about this so creatively. Lots of pressure to be a doctor. You know, family pressure was this is what you will do. And so he did. He became a doctor, but he really likes the outdoors and you know, climbing and kind of more of that extreme sports. So I just appreciated that here is a guy who found a way to do the thing to calm his parents down. He's a doctor, but on his own terms, he works very little. to be able to kind of live the life that was his own interest. And I get interested in people who kind of get creative like that, is and can kind of figure it out in their own terms. I don't know enough about his family history, that a lot of details, but I was just always interested in his creativity of going about that.
And I guess the ease with which somebody does or doesn't do that speaks to the pressure they were in, you know?
Yeah.
Sounds like even though he had pressure, he had some capacity to find his own path.
Yeah, to define a self, to say there's, I'm, this is the way I want to do. And I think it comes with, I think he's probably not as financially successful potentially as maybe his family wanted him to be, because he splits this energy. He does, he makes time for this passion of his.
It's interesting this point at which we diverge from the expectations of our family.
Yeah.
Do
Yeah.
you remember a time in your life? Is it, or was there a time where maybe you went in a different direction than, if it wasn't explicitly stated, there were some expectations?
I'd have to think about that. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. The first thing that came to my mind is a sporting example. My family were always big, like, let's do a sport. And I liked that. I like team sports. I think, like, I appreciated it. I played volleyball. I did, I'm very tall, so that's always useful in volleyball. Right, people see me sitting in this podcast, they don't know that. And by my senior year in high school, I knew I didn't want to play in university. It wasn't something that I wanted for myself. I was done. I played all year long, all the time. And so in my senior year, I decided to quit my club volleyball team, which I think, was a pathway that my parents were not as pleased with. It was a very challenging discussion. In retrospect, seems very simple, but at the time it felt very, very emotionally overwhelming and burdensome to be able to say, I don't want to do this anymore. And that, I mean, that's the example that came off the top of my head.
It's a great example growing up, you know.
Yeah.
I think about it, I can even see, I see it in my adult clients too, you know. This even though if their parents are around or not, we absorb the expectations of how something should look, and then it's hard to do something different from
Yeah.
our own thinking.
You know what I was
Interesting.
appreciating about this younger generation is, I think, I'm 47. I think there's less of a emphasis to think that you make a decision and you have to just kind of stick with it in your career path. And I mean, maybe you would observe something different, but I feel like there's a looseness about, if I decide to do this, there can be a turn in my pathway. Like, I'm not wedded to this one career or job or profession. If I decide later I want to do something different, I think that's kind of the part where people can have some work on differentiation, is if they get into something and decide, this isn't really what I want to be doing, that there's this, I don't know. I just observe maybe a little more flexibility in that somehow.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Maybe that flexibility would be part of something useful coming out of the new generation coming up, you know. Maybe it has something to do with the rigidness of the older generation.
That is, say more about that. Say more about that, Kieran. I'm interested in that comment.
I don't know. Generations tend to go either the same direction or a different direction than the generation above. You know, we respond or react to whatever the pressures were up there. So maybe that flexibility might be a positive part of feeling like you have to stay in something no matter what.
Yeah.
When it
I
stops
went
being useful.
I went a little Bowen nerd there, and how you might observe the variation in that for when someone does that more thoughtfully versus reactively, right? Like I always get interested in those
Yes.
generational shifts that seem more re reactively. But what would that look like when it's a thoughtful move to do something different?
Yeah, I think that's the challenging thing about working with clients and about Bowen theory, which is what we work in a lot, is the shift can be so subtle. The difference between just moving in one's own direction in a thoughtful way versus rebelling, let's say. And it makes the difference makes a difference.
And I think sometimes, what I find so interesting when I'm working on this stuff for myself is I might be doing the same behavior, but the difference it makes for me to be thinking about it or even, feeling about it differently, my nervous system responding differently lands differently.
With you and with others, or when you say land,
Yeah, I think both with me and with others. I think about that in parenting. That I can. I think parenting is such a great workout for us on our own functioning. It is for me. I could speak for myself. It's a workout for me and my own functioning and ways that I can just observe when I'm more stirred up, when even maybe it's not even me, like I had someone ask me the question the other day, even if I'm stirred up with my child, maybe it's not about the relationship with me and my child, the complexity of maybe I'm in a triangle I'm in, that triangle is stirred up and it's showing up over in this relationship, which would probably take me off on a tangent, but I was thinking about even when I can have that in my mind, my child is firing up right now. What part of that? How do I want to think about that? What's going on in my system versus just going towards her and trying to fix her?
Just rather than just moving to react to her emotion, to the having a way to think about it, that okay, she's reacting. How do I want to handle it?
Which is hard for me. It's hard for me to get there on a day to day.
I think it's hard for everybody, especially parents. I was talking with, speaking of parenting, I was talking with a parent the other day, and I wonder, like we were talking about the challenge of parenting being something like, as you are in this togetherness, you're this person is dependent on you, this child, fully dependent, and then as they develop, it's this negotiation of how do they take autonomy and you step back appropriately given a developmental level. What a challenge.
And I think one of the things that has been really useful to me when I can pull it up is that with clients and myself is that idea in theory about the reality needs. Because I think it's just so it's been just useful to me to get at what are the reality needs and capacities. I mean, I think both of my child, my child wanted to walk home from school, and we live about four blocks. And so funny to me as a kid who grew up as a latchkey kid, like this anxiety I have about her walking home by her. I had siblings. I think I have an only child, and so I was thinking about how this can stir up an anxiety in me while my child is asking for autonomy and independence, and she's a responsible kid. And so how do I manage? I mean, I think that's it. How do I manage the distress, which is probably not reality based in me, while she's asking for some more independence? Like that is a workout for me.
Oh, I believe it. I think it's a workout for every parent and for everybody. It happens. I think it happens in all relationships, right? When something's going on with the other person, how do I manage myself and not react as if it's personal right away?
I was talking to clinicians. Yeah, I'd be interested, Guillermo, as I was talking to a couple clinicians I supervise about that in the context of a session. How do you think about your functioning in that room while a client's talking with you about something challenging. Do you have, I mean, I know you supervise folks as well. How do you think about that?
Oh, I ask them all the time. How much of, you know, I'll ask them, how much of you offering homework in that moment was about your anxiety versus what's useful to the client?
Such a great example. Pull out the worksheets.
Pull out the worksheets. That's the clinician's anxiety. Yeah. You know? I think it's such a great question for people that are working on becoming therapists. Mm-hmm. You know, how can you get more aware of your anxiety and how it operates in your functioning in a room with somebody else?
Yeah. And the where you started this, I mean, the good news is likely if any clinician has any relationship that they're in, they have lots of, you know, practice. I would say playgrounds, laboratories, whatever you want to think of it, to practice this in every day, all the time.
I hear it. You know, you said, this reminds me of something you said earlier, that a lot of people get into the profession because they want to help. And you were curious and you wanted to explore and understand, which might be actually a more useful, to more useful position in general.
I have found, go ahead, sorry.
No, go.
I was thinking, I found when I probably do, now this is my own assessment, the worst therapy is when I'm working really hard to be helpful.
I can relate.
Yeah.
I can totally relate. How do you talk to your trainees about that?
I think I spend more energy on, I mean, I think we disclose we're a Bowen Theory training facility. So we talk to them about their family of origin. Because I will say during the interview, the things that you get caught in your family of origin, in my experience, are the things you get caught in the therapy room. The same kind of reactivity, the same automatic way that you move towards or away from people will exist in your family as it exists in your therapy room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can have a tendency to distance. And so I can watch myself and my own functioning in a therapy room. If something has, for lack of a better word, triggered me in the session, set off some reactivity, I can be really interested when I start thinking about the rest of my day in my head. Like that would be one of my like triggers for distance when I've left being present here in the room and I've gone into, okay, who's my next client or what do I have to do tonight? Or, you know, and I think that takes for the clinician slowing down to see that in real time. I think, you know, and I think to me, that's the work of differentiation, is that slowing that down. What is my automatic? How do I notice it? I can be looser in therapy usually in that role than I can in my own family. So, you know, observing it in the more extreme sense in your own family. So those would be some of the ways off the top of my head. I mean, how do you think about that?
Well, I think about it in the way we've been talking about it, how the clinician's anxiety comes in based on what sensitivities they developed in their own early relationships, you know, and what comes automatic to them out of that. You know? And one of the ways I work at it with them, and in my own life, has been, I ask, like, very similar to you, I ask them about their families.
Yeah.
So a lot of the supervision, a lot of our conversations are about how they function in their other relationships, and then how that might relate to what's coming up for them with a client or in the therapy room.
I think it's such a gift that a supervisor has. I mean, I know that different people in different, who practice from different theoretical models would think differently about it, but I just find the knowledge that I have when I'm supervising someone about their own family of origin, where they can be, you know, staff in a case, and then they talk about this relationship and they just can't see it. And I, you know, can say, you know, or does this person remind you of your brother, or, you know, or are, you know, and have that knowledge, or are you functioning and moving towards them the same way you do your mother? Just these little questions that I think are useful to people to connect and understand their own functioning.
Absolutely. There's also this great article. I don't know if you've ever read it. I think it's by Stephanie Ferrara. What is help? It's just title. It's a I give it to all my students. It's a great question to have in your training.
Yeah.
What is help? When is help not helpful? When?
Yeah, I know I hear Dan Paparo say it a lot too. What is the help that's helpful? And I think that is such a useful question for a clinician to think through. What is the help that's helpful? And then what is my automatic? So at least I know, as you asked me about my sibling position, right? I'm an older sister. So there can be a way when I sense a little bit of tension or disorganization, I can get real in there. And, you could ask my siblings. I don't think I was a hugely bossy older sister, but I was I always joke. I said, it always reminds me of that Hamilton song. I want to be in the room where it happens. Like I like knowing and being in the middle of things, for better or worse. And so that's the way I can kind of move in the middle of people when I and get a little directive, maybe.
I hear you. Mine's probably, I use distance like you, but I'm also a people. I was a people tend toward people pleasing, so I have to watch that showing up, and wanting the client to be comfortable so that I can be comfortable,
Which is such a great example of your worksheet thing. Like, I don't think it's good or bad, but like, how does if I can stay neutral, it definitely calms probably both the clinician and the client down. Oh, good. I have a thing that I can take and it's going to make things better, and maybe that's not the end of the world, but what are some other options? What are some other options to do in that moment other than hand the worksheet?
Yeah. Well, I think what it does sometimes is interrupt the necessary tension that somebody feels.
Such a good comment. How does the therapist manage when somebody is uncomfortable in the room?
Yeah, how do you stay out of the fact that the other person is having their own challenge and they need the tension to figure it out?
Which I appreciate. I think when I think with supervisees, I think that comes down to what are their belief systems? What are their principles of how they think people change? How do they understand what's useful to a system? They don't have to think of it the way I do. I think I find Bowen theory a real resource in thinking about that because I think at a fundamental level, it also fits with my own thinking about things. But that's so important to think if your belief system is my role in this room is to calm this person down and not let them feel any distress. You're going to be a very different therapist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Versus people need discomfort and tension to grow. And it's my job to facilitate their thinking about how they want to do that. And manage it.
I always said, I think I heard this quote, I'm not going to do it justice, but Denzel Washington said apparently, like, people have to get uncomfortable in order to make change. Why would anyone change if they were comfortable? And I thought that's great.
That is great. It is great. And I guess on the other side of it, if somebody's anxiety is too high, they can't think. So you have to bring the anxiety down enough where somebody can think. So it's an interesting thing to navigate.
Yeah, that. And how does a person, how do you measure that for yourself? What is the optimal level? Because, anxiety is not bad, I think is what we're saying here. It's useful.
Yeah, it's good.
What's the optimal kind of level of stirring up to still keep my thinking on board?
It's a great question. It's a great, question. I've been thinking about it in my it, a lot in my own life. I feel like when I well, now you got me thinking about it, Katie. When I feel like I'm taking responsibility for the things around me in a useful way, and when I feel like I'm moving forward towards what I feel is meaningful with purpose, I can relax when it's time to relax. You know, if I'm not doing it, then I'm not relaxing. I'm always anxious.
What a useful measure. Yeah.
You know,
So to know
that's what I found.
that ability to be kind of calm and regulated in the times
Yeah.
that is necessary, that is available, maybe.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Do you have any markers for you about that how to ride that tension, how to keep it, how to keep the strings taut enough so life makes music, maybe is a
Ooh,
metaphor.
that's a beautiful way to say it. I love that. I think I tend to learn after the fact. I
Oh,
would
me
say
too. You
my retrospective, like, oh, that was useful or that was less there. I'm not as good at kind of always going forward with it. I find when I lose the ability to notice things about me or notice, make observations, that's been a useful one recently, specifically for me to watch. Like if I, I'm in coaching and someone and my coach asked me, what was going on there, and I can't think about it, or I'm going into coaching and I think I lost the ability to recognize when I was in this situation with my family that who did what or what did I do or what was I thinking, or versus it might not be comfortable, but when I can say, I noticed this about me, or I noticed this about this relationship that I was in, to me, that's when the music is happening. When I'm just have a little more presence or awareness, even if it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, I like that. In the discomfort, I can keep an awareness of myself, of what's going on. Yeah. You just made me think of another one. Well, this idea of how, you can be doing a lot and be busy, but nothing ever gets done.
I don't know anything about that actually. Nothing, nothing.
When I'm feeling that, I know something's off. I know I'm not using my energy in the right way. Something's off in my thinking or in the direction where I'm going.
Yeah, and I can really, I mean, I think this is where the danger for my own brain is. I need to look at my behavior because I can do a good job of rationalizing my decisions and get caught sometimes. I think sometimes that's where I always joke that there can be a way that I can triangle in theory to kind of convince myself I'm functioning very maturely.
When it, would that be when you're over functioning?
Oh, yes, often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have at first I thought you were talking about like you have a prosecutor in your head, and I was thinking you need a defense attorney too, you
Probably do need a defense attorney. Yeah. Yeah.
Katie, we've kind of been talking about training more in a lot of ways of clinicians. How did these ideas, when we're talking about the therapist watching themselves, to me it's also resonant of working with couples, of what happens with couples, where they get stuck, what's useful, what's not useful. Is
Yeah.
any thoughts?
So I always say that I like my real love passion is family therapy, couples, like more than one person in the room. I love that kind of work because I was having a conversation with someone about this the other day about getting back into reading some early stuff, but I think something there is real live work on differentiation when you have more than one person in the room. versus when I can just talk to an individual. And then that's not bad work, just for the record. But I think there's something different that occurs. You know, I was sitting with a couple last night, and just the discipline it takes a person to keep their focus on themselves and how quickly it goes to the other. And like, I'm right in, I mean, I think the benefit to Bowen theory is you're doing work on your own family at the same time you're doing work as a clinician. And so I always say it's the easiest and quickest way to be humble as a clinician, because you know this is not easy. I know that I can get real focused on the things my husband's doing wrong, as much as when I'm sitting with a couple and, you know, just the act of really getting them to think about what are they willing to do and not do? What do they think? You know, how do they want to be as a spouse? Where do they lose that? I think that stuff is hard, but to watch it occur real time is, I just think it's fun. I mean, that's part of what keeps me, like, I just think it energizes me to watch people begin to hold on even for a minute of, I think this is the way I want to show up, even if my spouse might think a little differently than I do. I don't know if that's the question you were getting at, or if I'm doing a good job of explaining.
No, I think you're doing a great job. So tell me a little bit about how you think about couples therapy from a Bowen theory perspective, because it's different from what as I'm listening to you.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I like have this, I want to write this up in my mind to get clearer on it. So I'm gonna give you my, that was a useful question to push me further to write something up about this, because even though I dislike writing tremendously, I do notice I get clearer when I do write things down. Talking is easy for me. But I think the difference is, as I see it, is the focus is not on the fusion. The focus is not on creating sameness. Focused so much on the other. I think that a lot of couples therapy, really good or bad, I don't know, focuses on connecting with the other and being for the other and co-regulating with the other. And I think Bowen theory, using Bowen theory to work on couples therapy, has much more to do with managing yourself and staying in contact with another, which I think is different than co-regulating. I think it's self-regulation and contact. Now, that's just off the top of my head, so don't hold me to that when I get clear
No,
with
it's
my writing.
No, it makes a lot of sense that one way I've thought about it is reciprocity is always going on in a relationship, right? In other words, each person is influencing what the other one does all the time.
Yes.
And if I'm hearing your one way Bowen theories, some in other modalities they would say, okay, focus on kind of regulating each other in that reciprocity. And Bowen theory saying, no, that reciprocity is going on, and the way to work at it is to manage yourself and your reactivity and stay connected to your partner in this thing that's always going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that if you
Yeah.
do that, the reciprocity shifts a little bit.
And I think the thing that I find useful when I'm talking with couples, and the thing I think they find useful, is it is work that I imagine is more under a person's control. If I'm working to manage me, I have that control. I know this from years of experience. When I'm working to manage someone else, I don't have any control over that. I mean, maybe when my child was a baby and I could physically pick them up, you know, but I think that is the buy-in for couples that I work with, is you can go in out of this room and you can work on that piece for yourself. You cannot work on changing your spouse.
I think that's the trick, right? Is that you get to work on yourself and you can work on yourself. I love that. I wonder who was regulating who when you picked up your baby, by the way.
Yeah. That's such a good observation. You know, watching newborns with their parents, it's so fun when you have that lens of what just being curious and interested about that. With all of our kids, you know, I was just went off a family vacation, and I was so interested when my child got really distressed, and I was able to move towards her, which kept me out of a conflict that was happening over here. And I thought, there is the system. There is my daughter thinking she's helping me out as I move towards her to stay away from whatever's going on over here. I don't know. I haven't thought enough about it, if it's useful or not, or what I learn out of that, but yeah.
I think it can be both sometimes.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah.
There's just back to this idea of couples for a second. I think, do you have them in some couples therapy? They have them sit to ch and talk to each other, which is the co-regulation. In Bowen theory, it's different. Is it? Do you practice that way where they sit separate to talk to you?
Yeah, so I defined that from the beginning about how I think differently, that the work that we will do together is that they will talk to me and they will listen to their partner. And some people really hate that. Or just I'm thinking about that this couple that I worked with years ago, that it was they found it so fun to just notice how quickly they each turn towards each other when I asked them a question. And I got up on the board, I kind of drew a triangle and got interested with them. And I just think that is useful to think about that regulation piece, that this man would turn to his husband and look almost for his approval as he's answering me the question. And I so yeah, so my work is to have the folks each talk to me while they're thinking about the question that I'm bringing them, and then to ask, what was happening for the other person as they're listening. What do they notice? Where did they lose their ability to think about what the person was talking about? Because that's useful too. When they start responding and defending themselves, right? How quickly that happens, how quickly they stop listening or regulating themselves.
Yeah, you're when that was an interesting example where he looks to his husband as he's answering a question you asked him about him.
Yeah.
He's looking to the other to see for approval, disapproval. And that's what goes on with couples when they're alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're so sensitive to each other for good and for better and worse.
Yeah, and I think I mean, I guess, I think sometimes Bowen theory can get a bad rap about being too cerebral and too cognitive. And I think this can happen on such a physiological level as well, just to notice, I think the body and the nervous system can be such a useful litmus test to figure out what's happening when you're in conversation, when I'm talking to one partner. What does the other partner notice as being stirred in them? It's another way to think about
Absolutely.
it.
Absolutely. And I think the mystery of it, the paradox is that if I can manage myself more, if you're working with a couple and each person can manage themselves a little better, pay more attention to what goes on physiologically, emotionally, in their thinking, that can actually make a better connection, a deeper connection.
Yeah. And I think that's true, and I watch it happen. And yet I think I'd be interested in your ideas on the hook in for that for people. Because I think for some people that's really uncomfortable territory to not think about that togetherness piece, that I should be working to connect more, be more for the other. And you definitely would hear those conversations. Well, I hear them in couples therapy. How do people hold on or invest in seeing that play out? How do you watch that in your work?
That's a great question too. Well, I mean, how do I watch it play out? How do people get in? Sound like one question was, how do people get invested in it? How do you hook them? I try
Yes,
to
that's a good way.
I try to introduce the idea, the concept. And I also challenge at times this being for the other as more about the individual's anxiety about being approved or validated or not feeling connected, you know, or about their own stuff, their own
Yeah.
reactivity. It's diff because it is in some ways, and you tell me, I've been thinking about this, there is each individual, but there's also the relationship, you know. And so it's not either or, it's they both exist simultaneously.
Yeah.
It's separate and connected. So I try to present it that way.
I appreciate that. And I think that I do that in a way of also getting interested in how they can observe themselves in other relationships. So reciprocity, each relationship has a different level of reciprocity, a different way that we would get stirred up or we would function. And so I think that's another window into that that I try and think about with people is how do they observe. Where else do they observe this same pattern?
Okay, so one way I've seen it with clients play out is when I can get to a point where I can start asking them about their family of origin, you can see the other person get curious. And that to me is really interesting because they're not focused on the tension between them. They're focused on each other as individuals that they're connected to, interested in.
Do you do a family diagram when you have a couple in front of you?
Yeah, at least it, for myself, if even if I don't show it to them.
Yeah, I think that is one of the places where I always say, and sometimes in therapy people have those light bulb moments. And I think that is one of the ways where I watch really, especially in couples therapy. Because it is one person telling me about their family where their spouse is listening, where their spouse might say, huh. I say, those are my favorite moments in therapy where someone goes, huh, think of it that way. Or I didn't notice that your parents' marriage, or your relationship with your mother has some of the similar qualities to the way we get, into trouble. Or, I think those are ways that I just find are such gems in therapy. And it's looser, like I think you were describing. Like it's a different way because it's not about them. It's them thinking about their partner's relationship with these other people. It's a little looser.
And it can open things up a little bit, like you're saying. Katie, you work, I know you work with couples. Do you see families? Do you see more than two people at times?
This is what I was talking to someone about the other day is my hope is to do more of this. I think I did, I did a lot of this when I worked in public mental health, where I actually went into people's homes. There's a useful
Oof.
way to sit with a family and watch dynamics in real time is to be in their home with them, thinking with them. But I do as when it's possible. The world that I, the clientele that I exist, logistics become a real thing, which is, we were talking earlier about the things that I put into my life, right, to keep busy. I think families are up against that too. So, I've sat with some adolescents and their parents. I don't really work with young kids anymore, but not as often as I think it would be useful, I guess, is what I'm saying here. Do you?
I don't have, I'm not seeing anybody right now. I've
No, okay.
seen parents and kids, usually one parent and a kid, every once in a while too. What's been your experience with not seeing little kids? Or what's the thinking behind that?
I have some real clear principles on why I don't see children on their own. Because I did that for a long time. I mean, that's the like the politics I'll throw in here. I think the funding often goes into people working one-on-one with children. And I think when
Yeah.
children can go to therapy, it calms the system down until it doesn't. I think that's one thing I've just observed over time. But the part that I really have a strong principle about is I don't think children have the capacity for leadership in a family to make sustainable change. So when I think about working one-on-one with a child, I think I've just observed it too many times where then they go back into their system. They're a little more thoughtful, maybe they have some tools under their belt, but as the system reacts in its predictable way, then quite often the behavior that the child was being referred to therapy will come back. So I think from a leadership perspective, I just find working with parents is more useful for the system. I mean, I think that's my principle. I think they have more capacity to enact change, lasting change on a system. How do you think about it?
No, I would tend to agree with you that I haven't found it particularly useful to work with little kids individually. And usually I think well, now I won't do it. But even in the beginning, I said, I would say, I'll see him, but only if you come in too.
And that's not to say that I definitely think that there are family systems that have a lot of stressors present, where having a place where a child can have a
And
little bit
go.
of peace is useful. I mean, I'm not anti-kid therapy. I mean, please don't hear me say that. I think that there are some systems where parents have so much going on that they might not have the capacity to work on themselves. And you know what? That's fair. We all come in with different things we're able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's addressing a real problem to have these spaces for children. And it serves its purpose, you know. But there is something about change coming from, like you said, the parental leadership. That's it's more likely to happen from there.
And I think I've learned that in multiple systems. You know, I think, I don't know if you know my story, but I came into Bowen Theory really through an organizational, Jenny Brown was hired to supervise my supervision. That's what the title was. She was a supervisor of supervision. And so she consulted with the organization I was working with. And where I found Bowen Theory immediately useful was thinking about triangles and dynamics in an organizational capacity. And so to think about the role of a leader in a organization like was so appealing to me at that time. I had just moved to another country, I was in a new job, I was in leadership, I had a different way of thinking about things, and it was just really useful to put some language and some theory around what I observed was happening and what was happening for me. I mean, I was finding myself anxious and I couldn't figure out what I was anxious about in this workplace. And so I think that trickles down for me into family work, is that there is something about a leader in a system, regardless of what that system is.
Yes. What did you learn at that time? What was something that came out of that?
I learned that I more than I knew invited myself into triangles more than I was aware, and I think that has been tremendously useful to me in my personal and professional life, is just to observe how automatic and willing I am to invite myself into a triangle. Be helpful often.
Do you find that that's something other leaders you've worked with do often? Is it a common obstacle in leadership?
I think especially, I mean, the places I have spent my career is in a helping profession. So in public mental health, in charity mental health. I haven't worked in the business world, so I don't know how it functions there. But I think you have the perfect storm when you have people who get into a profession that want to help and often will give up self to help other. And then you put them in leadership positions running organizations with lots of stakeholders, lots of interlocking triangles. I think I watched it time and time again and continue to watch it when I interact with those organizations.
So when you say a lot of stakeholders, is a lot of potential anxiety that gets generated?
Around, I think around we could extend this into a societal level, right? Around resources,
Funding.
funding, people's functioning, where resource allocation will go. I mean, I think about that anxiety exists from a societal level, a governmental level to a family, right? How does a family decide? I love to read and I love to read historical fiction. And I just get so interested in the resource. Like if you listen to families where gender was a big thing on how the family decided where resources were going. And in the days, those girls weren't getting a lot of resources, financial resources, time resources, support resources. So, I just get interested in how a family and an organization goes about allocating that and the anxiety it can cause. I just watched how much stress and tension that factor alone just creates.
And if I'm hearing you right, the leader that's a helper, under that stress, involves themselves kind of in everything to try to make everybody happy.
Yeah.
And
Which is
that's and
impossible.
yeah. And a good way to burn out.
And that's what you find. I mean, and I think I observe in lots of helping professions the burnout and then the distance. And then, the distance to manage self, which of course, so you go from being overly involved to, pulling right back. I talk to a lot of people in healthcare, and I think this is something post-COVID that field is really struggling with the impact of all of that the tension, the resource allocation, the polarization that occurred. I think that's all still in that system that's really challenging the practitioner.
That's interesting that I think if I'm hearing you right, anxiety doesn't go away all of a sudden. It can sit there.
Not in my experience. And again, like I don't want to think of anxiety. I mean, I think in Bone Theory, anxiety can do a lot of good. I don't want to,
Pushes change.
I don't want to say that it's a bad thing because I think it does. I mean, it's the only way we're existing and moving forward as a species in the world. Like it's the thing that
It drives adaptation.
well said. Yeah.
I hear you.
But there's that tipping point, I think, sometimes though.
Who wrote that? Who wrote that book, The Tipping Point?
Malcolm Gladwell, I think
Ah, that's right. That's right.
I like his observation. I think another person who just observes patterns in interesting ways and makes me think. I appreciate reading some of his ideas around that tipping point of when things shift.
Are you still working with organizations?
I don't consult to organizations. I don't do that work. I just was in the I was actually formally in the organization. And because I'm an older sister of sisters who finds herself in leadership roles, I've had the privilege of being in leadership roles where I got to interact with quite a bit of different organizations. I mean, when I was working in Phoenix in Arizona, my title at one point was the System of Care Manager. What an interesting title. But what it was I was a manager in an organization that managed the funding for the highest level of need children in the public mental health system. And so I got to interact with lots of systems. That was such a useful education, juvenile justice, the child protection system, the mental health system, the family systems. And, it was really useful training in my understanding of systems.
That's interesting. When you said, what was it? What was your title? Systems
System
manager.
of care manager.
All I heard was older sister.
That's so true. They were like, "Where is the older sister in the room? There she is." I worked with a bunch of this is what you will find, I think, often in public mental health. I worked with a lot of other older sisters.
Interesting.
I
Interesting.
had a team of older sisters. I
Yeah.
don't think we laughed about it at the time, but.
And now you're the t tell me a little bit about your position now. You're the executive director of Living Systems.
Yes, yeah, so Living Systems has been around in Vancouver for over 50 years. It's taken lots of different, it's one of these programs that grew out of a church basement. The church, one of the churches in West Vancouver said, our populations need some resources around education and counseling. And so, grassroots people put some things together and it grew out of that to serve not just the church, but the larger community. And then, ooh, I should check my history. Ron Richardson was recruited at some point who had some interest in Bowen theory. He tells the story that someone handed him Bowen's anonymous chapter. He was looking for something different. He did, in the 70s and 80s, he was trained as a pastor and then a marriage and family therapist. And he said he wasn't finding in his work success, or he wasn't finding that the things he was doing were working. Lots of emotive stuff at that time, or behavioral stuff. And so someone handed him apparently Bowen's anonymous chapter, and said, "I heard you're looking for something different. This guy's doing something different." And he said right away, he was hooked. Like he said, it was very different. He had never thought about his own family system. He'd done lots of therapy, but in that way. And so he ended up forming a training component that really exclusively trained people from Bowen theory, just by reading the books and trying to work it out and testing it out. So Living Systems then grew to have this counseling and training arm, which we still do today. So we run a nonprofit counseling agency where we see people on a sliding scale. So to provide resources to people who might not be able to afford counseling, as well as we have people who see folks who can pay a little more. And then we have a training program where we train a few different arms. We train clinicians, but we also just train people who are interested in learning more about Bowen theory as a resource. So lots of different ways we do that. And then we do have a ministry program as well, where we train ministers who are interested in using Bowen theory as a resource. I think that's what we do.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly interesting. And no, a church is definitely a relationship system, you
Yes.
know.
Yes. Yes.
That's it, ministers.
And we had I get interested at that, how a lot of ministers have found Bowen theory really resourceful to their work. That has been one community that has really taken Bowen theory and ran with it. I think more so potentially than the clinical community in some realms and in today's world.
Yeah, what do you think that is? I could see that ha happening. I don't know many counseling programs or universities that kind of come from a Bowen theory perspective or from a family systems perspective, really, other than just an overview. What's your sense of what goes into that?
Well, I probably have lots of thoughts. I'm going to edit the thoughts that I have. I think part of it is I think psychology clinical work goes through trends. I think, and I think when family therapy in the heyday, the age of that, I think it was potentially in a reactive response to another
Yeah,
beyond
trimmed.
psychoanalysis, where it was just a one person sitting, on a couch forever. I think the family work was kind of in response to that. And I think it does go through waves and trends. And I think this is, the system. I think we're in a trend where systems are being looked at, but I think people are really interested in the brain systems and understanding that piece of it, which I think is fascinating. But I think that, looking at the family is just not.
It's not sexy.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's messy and it's, I think it's hard. I think it's, I said that even earlier about the logistics of it. I also think much more now than when I was early. I mean, so like 25 years, I think I'm coming up to. I think the business of therapy is so interesting right now
Yes.
in a different way. I think in a very different way of and I think that creates different modalities. That there is a real, I don't know how to say that, like a business behind it, that I think people who were doing their family therapy in the 70s and 80s, it was less of a, I'm going to make lots of money and I need to put all these pieces. And we're in a very different world than we were in the 70s and 80s. I mean, look at us. Here we are
Yeah,
talking
online.
across the country. The continent and country, I suppose I should say.
I think you're right. People are really interested in the brain systems, but not in how the brain is part of a relationship system.
I saw, I was, I just, because I, like I said, I like to learn. So I really nerded out and challenged my brain and went recently to a day of a behavioral neuroendocrinology conference. So there was, I'm
Ooh.
right by the University of British Columbia and they were having this conference and I wanted to see the speaker that was there who does some brain work that I was interested about, because she's looking at the interactions of hormones in the system. And so I walked around the poster presentation where there were 75. This I just went one day and on that one day there were 75 posters that were up in this room that I could walk around and talk to people. And I kept asking people questions about reciprocity or the interaction. They're looking very much at, they do animal models and they're looking at a lot of the individual. And, I thought part of what I can do here is just get curious about what do you notice about the variation in the interaction, not just in what's happening in the individual, the interaction. And I think I got some of the feedback that is part of what I'm saying here, which, ooh, that would be hard to study. It would
Oof.
be hard to measure both the mouse that's interacting with the mouse and the mouse we have all the electrodes on. Like that would just, and then to study not just what's in one and what's in another, but what's happening between. I just, and I can appreciate that. I don't, I, you know, but maybe that question sent their brain in a little bit of a different direction.
That's a it's a great great question, and a great illustration of what is the challenge for thinking in terms of family systems. It is incredibly hard to research. There's a guy I've been reading. Have you ever heard of Ian McGilchrist?
Sounds familiar.
He wrote, I think his the first book is The Master and His Emissary. And the second one is The Matter with Things. But he talks about the hemisphere differences in the brain and how everything we knew was kind of not accurate. And he did all his research on this. But he also has really sees the things, the brain as relational, as a part of a relationship process that we participate in. Anyway, he's fascinating to read.
Well, and Guillermo, I think that's what, so part of my nerding out is I'm really interested in hormone regulation between people. Like we know that hormones are responsive to relationship, right? There's a lot of things that people think about. And what I really appreciated about this group of people that I sat in a room with and tried to absorb all their intelligence, that was my fusion I was hoping for. But is is how the complexity of the tools they have are helping them think about this and how they're learning. You know, like you said, I think that the ways that they understood the brain and the functioning of the nervous system. I mean, I think that's one thing. Like, they're not just talking about the brain anymore. That's e even that is a useful shift to say this isn't a brain thing. This was a nervous,
Yeah,
this is a nervous system
your
thing.
system.
But to think about, like, they didn't, a lot of the things they talked about at this conference was for a long time they didn't study women, right? Like, so there was one way of thinking about how these factors responded in a male rat or, you know, mouse or whatever, or human. But to think about this other piece of looking at the different genders and then how different genders respond differently, biological genders, I'll say for the record, on differently to different hormone stimulation. And so I think, you know, all of this to me is a useful way to understand the system, because I think what I get curious about, this is me really nerding out with you here, so tell me if I'm not, is I think this Bowen's idea of the emotional system to this automatic thing in us, I get interested in how hormones are a piece of that, you know, all that piece of the way that both responding within and between would be regulated in some way by that hormonal response in the body. So that's where I was going with that nerding out. I'm not clear on it. I want to keep thinking about it. The science sometimes really bogs me down. There's too many different types of estrogen and testosterone and receptors, and I don't know. It's a lot. It's a lot to think through.
Yeah, but if I'm hearing you, the basic idea is that the hormones would be something you could look at to try to get at the reciprocity between people,
Yeah.
that the whatever you're measuring, the levels are affected to some degree and by the interactive process,
Yeah, the
and
reciprocity.
regulate that process.
Yes, and the variation. I mean, I think when we talk about the, you know, the level of differentiation and the variation in people and systems and families, I think, you know, maybe that could be one way to think about learning about that variation, is that, you know, one family would respond and one body would respond quite differently than another. And I think that, you know, and for the record, I don't want to do the research myself. I want someone else to do it and I can just absorb it.
Yeah. Well, that's why we're talking about it.
Yeah. But I think there's something, I mean, I'm really intrigued about, you know, the question of, you know, I think I heard Bowen used to say, what's the glue? What's the glue that keeps us together? You know, what's the even when families are cut off, you know, I can observe that glue is still present. And I wonder about what is that?
That even if families, two people aren't talking to each other, there's still some connective tissue.
Something. Yeah.
And that's present in all relationships.
I think so. I think not. I mean, this is where, you know, you were on
Well,
our
with family,
podcast
maybe. Yeah.
but I think also there's some friends that, or I think there's people that might not be in the family system per se that can be in that emotional system. I mean, that's one of my, I think I'm pretty solid on that, to think it doesn't need to just be the family system. I think there is something, there are people that are adjacent to the family system. I would have to think about a way of measuring what, you know, I keep asking people that question. What include, how do you include, how do you decide who to include in an emotional system?
That's a great question. That's a great question.
Because I think that I would definitely put people who are not married into my family or biologically connected to me in my emotional system.
Me too. I have a couple I'm thinking of right now. So, do you have an answer, Katie? What is the glue that holds this together?
I do not, but I like the question because it keeps me thinking. And I think, you know, it keeps me interested in this profession too. You know, I think when you talked about burnout, I think, you know, I will say when I'm training clinicians, like, We hear really hard things.
Yeah.
We hear hard things. We hear and we sit with people that are really up against it. And I need to have a way to continue to think about what it is that keeps me getting back into that room and that seat and wanting to think with these people and having and believing that I am a resource to thinking with people. And I think this curiosity of what is the glue is one of those questions that just keeps me interested in learning about systems and people and families and relationships.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's going to just be a more and more important question, especially as we get more technologically advanced.
What do you think about that?
But I think it's going to be a more important question. I think people are going to rely or start to get more curious about human connection, would be my hypothesis.
Yeah. How would you measure that? I mean, I think that's a great hypothesis. How would you measure just even in your own system to watch the movement of people getting more interested in human connection?
Well, I think if I'm not wrong, I've been hearing stories about the younger generation coming up not wanting to be as much on their cell phone or different things where they're kind of pushing aside technology and
Yeah.
so not getting rid of it, but just managing it differently.
Yeah, I hear that too.
And that might be an indicator.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to be interested in this. Yeah. I mean, they're just growing up in such a different world. I mean, I think that that's, I was listening to someone on a podcast talk about the gift of being born in the 70s and 80s. I was of a generation where I did not have technology like we do now when I was growing up. I mean, I remember getting our first computer and I was a late cell phone adapter, mainly because I didn't have a lot of money. The therapist con, right? I think I was in my like early 20s before I had a cell phone. So just really seeing such a different world than I just went on a family vacation to, I said to you, to Florida in an amusement park. And I just was so interested as we're standing in line for this amusement park, how quickly the devices come out. And I'm interested in that.
I hear it.
Yeah.
I think human connection is where purpose and meaning lie. And that's just maybe that's my own bias, but
Well, I'm biased with you. We'll have some togetherness there. Yeah. Whereas I watched in these lines, travel is such an interesting thing because you just see these people. Like I saw what was waiting in one line and I saw someone have a hat. We keep saying we need to do a podcast episode on sports because I think it's such an interesting connector. Someone was wearing a hat. Someone across the row was like, yeah, go team. And I proceeded to watch them have a whole conversation and talk about family and talk about this all around. They cheered for the same sports team.
Isn't that cool?
I thought it was really interesting. That human connection.
And the things that connect us.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it.
Sports does it.
Katie, tell me about your podcast.
Oh, yes. So our podcast is called Elevator Systems. And I should have had the pitch. The pitch is Bowen Theory in a Brief for a Lifetime of Learning. So one of our faculty members, Dixie Vandersloos, had this idea for a podcast and said, I think that there aren't that many things out there to really talk about Bowen Theory in a brief, more relaxed way. I think sometimes, and she thought she believes in Bowen Theory and wants to get it out there and have more people exposed to these ideas. So she proposed this podcast, said, would you be willing to be my co-host on it? And I thought to myself, oh gosh, do I really want to go on? But I think, as you would know from me talking today, I really have a hard time saying things briefly. So it was such a useful challenge to say, I want to look at these ideas in Bowen Theory in a brief way. And I still am not great at that, but just it's been so useful to me to think about the theory for myself more in a in a way to say, how do I tell this to someone else? Like, I can think about this and I can have a way of understanding this. Teaching helps that, I think, but how would I say this to someone else? So we are in our third season. We're nearly halfway through our third season, which just blows me away. The first season we just did the concepts. The second season we followed similar to the concepts. We did it along the same track that Bowen did his Chalk Talks, so kind of that topic order. And then this season, which thank you for being one of our guests, we looked and took Bowen theory into relationships. So we've kind of done relationships through the life cycle. And then we already have next season will be, let's see. So more still Bowen theory out and about, less about family relationships. We're looking at sort of other contexts, where Bowen theory is a resource to people. And, you know, it's been fun. I get to, and the other part that I am a social person, and I really have appreciated just connecting with other people who are using Bowen theory and hearing their thinking. You know, I think that's been a real gift of this podcast to connect, you know, various people in the wider Bowen network and get to know them a little bit. Yourself, you know, it's been great.
It's been great indeed.
Yeah.
Man. Thank you, Katie. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
You got it.
All
See
right.
ya.